Understanding the complex fixed income environment is critical to your portfolio's success. VettaFi's Fixed Income Symposium is happening April 18th and brings the experts and thought leaders straight to you. Hear the insights you need to succeed in 2024. Register for free at etftrends.com.
ETF Prime is hosted by Nate Geraci, president of investment advisory firm, The ETF Store. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. Investing in ETFs involves risk, including potential loss of principal. Any past performance figures discussed are not necessarily indicative of future results.
Some guests appearing on this program may also be financial sponsors of ETF Prime. The ETF Store is not affiliated with VettaFi or any of its affiliates. VettaFi's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or indication by VettaFi of the value of any ETF Store product or service. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate will help you get up to date with what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, joining me will be Felix Tabari, co-founder and CEO of Troop, who, this is interesting, so Troop is attempting to make it much easier to build and apply custom proxy voting policies across portfolios. And longtime listeners know this is a topic I've discussed quite a bit in the past, proxy voting and ESG, and whether companies like Vanguard and BlackRock are wielding too much power in corporate boardrooms. We're actually seeing this play out right now with Disney. There's a battle over board seats. And of course, I've talked about ETF issuers like Strive and Engine Number One who are attempting to vote proxies in a particular manner. But I'm going to get into all of this with Felix and how Troop is attempting to help direct shareholder activism. Again, this should be a really interesting conversation. Also joining me will be Jess Bost, Vice President of Strategic Partnerships at Alpha Architect, who currently offers 10 ETFs, nearly $4 billion in assets, though the topic of our conversation will actually be on ETF model portfolios and specifically how advisors can use ETFs to simplify and optimize their portfolio construction process. I feel like Jess has a very unique framework around this, which she'll share. And then she's also going to offer some tips on filtering through the 3,400 plus ETFs as part of that process. Now, to start this week, I am joined by the one and only Todd Rosenbluth, head of research at VettaFi, who has provided me with the latest advisor polling data from the recently held equity symposium. And I've got to tell you, there are some meaty topics for us to dive into here. Definitely a few surprises in the survey data, I would say, but really just some timely ETF topics overall. So let's visit with Todd now.
Now we're joined by the experts at VettaFi, a new data analytics and thought leadership company that is transforming financial services from an industry to a community, one relationship at a time.
$800 billion, I think we have to say that again. $800 billion and counting for an industry that is still growing in size is impressive.
Todd, always a pleasure. Thank you for joining me.
It's my pleasure. Great to be with you again.
All right. So look, real quick, before we get into the survey data I mentioned, there was some interesting news related to ETFs last week where I'm sure you saw this. Bloomberg reported that Fidelity is going to charge a $100 fee to their clients who wish to buy ETFs from nine issuers. That includes Simplify ETFs and Axis Investments. And I just thought this was a noteworthy story to cover on the podcast. This caught me a little by surprise, I would say. I'm just curious, did you have any reaction to that?
Well, I remember back in the day, and maybe you and the listeners would, that, you know, 2017, 2018, 2019, give or take, when we didn't have commission-free trading on for ETFs on Schwab and Fidelity and the various platforms. That's actually only been around for 5 or 6 years. It used to be only selected ETFs. So on Fidelity's platform, you could trade Fidelity ETFs, and iShares was their preferred partner. Schwab had a select list of products, not from any asset manager beyond their own, but some from WisdomTree and from Xtrackers and JP Morgan. And essentially, asset managers would pay to be on that commission-free platform. Where it sounds like we're headed back to that, where Fidelity is going to fund its commission-free trading of ETFs from the asset managers if they're willing to pay it. And if not, then the end investor is going to have to pay in order to trade on Fidelity's platform. I wish this was not the case, but distribution success is not for free. This is a for-profit business within the ETF industry, and this is how the world works. So I'm not that surprised by it, but I certainly wish that ETFs were available for everybody on a level playing field.
Yeah, I think my disappointment here is you and I always talk about how ETFs have democratized investing and brought all of these innovative strategies and access to asset classes to everyday investor. A lot of strategies and asset classes that were previously only available to institutional investors. And I 100% agree with what you're saying in terms of, look, these are a platform like Fidelity. This is a for-profit business. They have to make money. I get all that. I just worry that actions such as this disproportionately impact smaller ETF issuers. And you may disagree with this. I would mount the argument, and maybe we should do this on a future podcast, that the smaller ETF issuers are really the incubators of innovation and asset management. And so if you kind of connect the dots here, which I don't think is hard to do, I think when you start putting up gates like this, it really impacts smaller issuers. And so some of the innovation doesn't make its way into the hands of investors, because obviously smaller ETF issuers don't have the same type of financial wherewithal as your largest issuers, who this is a drop in the bucket. If they have to pay Fidelity for whatever they're calling it, a maintenance arrangement or operations or however they're positioning it, that's no big deal for somebody like BlackRock or Vanguard. But for somebody, say, like Simplify ETFs, that's a meaningful expense on their financials. And so maybe they can't do it. And I guess the other thing I would say here, too, if you're going to do something like this, I hear what you're saying, how all these platforms went to commission-free trading. But even back when they were charging commissions in that 2017 timeframe, we were talking about what, a $9.95, $9.99 ticket charge? This is a $100 fee. I mean, I could see you have somebody go in and try to buy one of these ETFs, not realizing that they're getting dinged for $100. I guess that part maybe stuck out to me more than anything. But I just worry. I don't like seeing. We've always known that there's gatekeeping in the ETF industry. That's nothing new, especially when you start talking about the wirehouse world and the process that you have to go through if you're an ETF issuer to have your products on those platforms and then be accessible by the advisors there. I just somebody like Fidelity, like, does this really matter at the end of the day to them? This I talked about for the larger issuers, this not being a big expense. What about for somebody like Fidelity? Are they really making that much revenue off something like this that it's worth the negative PR?
I hear you, and this will certainly, for someone who's coming to market and expecting that if they start with an asset base of seed capital of $1 million. They have to build in now that there's a cost to being available, having their ETFs available on a platform. And maybe that holds them back from launching the ETF. I hope that isn't the case, but yeah, I can certainly see I see why this caught your eye. I see why this is not ideal.
Yeah, and on the other hand, I think longtime listeners know at the end of the day, look, I'm a free market capitalist. So look, you're running a business, you can do whatever you want. I'm also obviously a huge ETF industry advocate. And again, I just feel like the smaller issuers are where a lot of the innovation is happening. And I worry that moving forward, actions such as this, especially if we see more of them, really can hurt that innovation. But in any event, let's move on. So VettaFi hosted this equity symposium for financial advisors a few weeks ago. And as part of that, as you typically do with these events, VettaFi surveyed those advisors on a variety of topics. You have been kind enough to share the results with myself and obviously ETF Prime listeners this week. And I think you know, Todd, I just love going through this type of data because it provides a real-time window into how advisors are thinking, which obviously that impacts their clients' experience, but it also impacts things like ETF flows, which you and I both like watching. And I would say even how ETF issuers approach new launches and those sorts of things. So let's just dive in here and go through some of the findings. I pulled out a number of the questions that I found particularly interesting. So again, let's just dive in. And first, VettaFi asked the question, which factor looks appealing to you in the current environment? And the top two responses by far were growth with 37% and quality with 26%. So let's start there. What did you make of those results?
Yeah, I'm going to take a slight step back just to set the stage. We did a couple-hour event. There were almost 500 live attendees, primarily financial advisors. So this is a good cross-segment. Again, this is a sample, and this is self-selected advisors that are responding to this. But I'm not surprised that growth was at the top of the list. And some people don't think of growth as a factor the same way they think of quality and value, momentum, low vol, size, but growth is a factor. And we're seeing, obviously, the mega cap growth stocks led the market in 2023 and to start beginning of 2024. So I'm not surprised growth was at the top of the list. Quality is encouraging to me. Quality is one of those, you know it when you see it, you think, but that's companies with strong balance sheets and consistent earnings records and often free cash flow generation. And I love this data too, so much that I end up writing articles on ETFtrends.com about the output of that data and then examples of ETFs. So let me just highlight a couple of ETFs that I recently wrote about. American Century has a U.S. quality growth ETF. The ticker is QGRO, QGRO, that combines that quality and growth metric. So strong balance sheets, consistent earnings records, but also growth traits. And so companies like ServiceNow and TJX and Booking Holdings are some of the examples of what's inside the portfolio. And then I recently wrote yesterday about the Cash Cows ETF. And now the Pacer U.S. Cash Cow ETF, Cows, COWZ, is the most popular of these free cash flow ETFs. But we also touched on the Victory Shares free cash flow ETF because it has a growth tilt. So VFLOW, that's the Victory Shares ETF, takes a more forward-looking approach to cash flow, which has actually helped it to outperform a little bit better in 2024. And just one quick note, I don't know if you saw this yesterday, but iShares announced that it's going to change one of its traditional growth-oriented ETFs into a quality growth at a reasonable price ETF under the ticker GARP, G-A-R-P, in a couple of months. So it's going to be value and quality together. So tilting away from growth and into more value to offer a twist towards the very popular QUAL ETF.
I did not see that. What a great ticker symbol, by the way. I wonder how long they've been sitting on that. I know. that's wild. My quick comment here, I agree with you. The interest around growth is no surprise given the performance we've seen there. With quality, I don't think this is anything enlightening. I do think there is a growing segment of advisors who are looking out on the economic horizon here. And there is some concern that perhaps we get a slowdown or the Fed doesn't quite get this this landing right. And if you believe that's the case, you probably want to be positioned in more of a quality fashion. So that makes sense to me that there's interest there. And as you've highlighted, there's no shortage of ETF products in that space. All right, the next polling question that I found interesting was this one. So how much of your equity exposure in average client portfolios is in actively managed strategies? And the results here were more dispersed than that last question. So about 32% said more than half of their client portfolios were in active strategies. 21% said between 26 and 50% of their client portfolios were in active strategies. 23% said between 11 and 25% of portfolios. And then the rest was less than 10%. Did those results surprise you at all? I guess I would have thought a smaller percentage in active overall, but maybe I'm just biased towards indexing.
So it is, the numbers are different than we would have expected. I would have thought we would have seen a lower percentage in actively managed strategies. Now, I wrote the question intentionally a little vague. So it doesn't say actively managed ETFs. It didn't say actively managed funds. It said actively managed strategies, in part because we had, during this equity symposium, we had some active equity mutual fund participants. So that's certainly probably in the mix. This isn't just all ETFs. And you as an advisor, if you own in a couple of individual stocks, you might consider that to be an actively managed strategy that you are actively managing. But that said, I am excited about what this means for the ETF industry. As you know, active ETFs have been punching above their weight. They did so in 2022. They did so in 2023. To start this year in 2024, they've been popular as well, both active equity and active fixed income. Some of that data is skewed by BlackRock putting active ETFs in their model portfolios away from indexing products. But I do think it's encouraging. There's still a lot of money in actively managed mutual funds. We as an industry in the ETF space, notice the net outflows, but there's still a lot of money that's there that might move over to the active ETF space as many of these firms come to market with an active equity version of some of their popular strategies. And whether it's Capital Group, that's the success that it's had that we've talked about, you know, Morgan Stanley has recently expanded into the active space, and we've got BlackRock doing so, as I talked about, with some of their model efforts. So this is encouraging to me for active management in the ETF space.
Yeah, 100% agree with your broad takeaway there. That's exactly what I thought. So while the results here surprised me a little bit, it is also reflective of the interest we are seeing around active ETFs. And you just named some of the major players that are either now getting involved or getting much more involved in the active ETF arena. So that momentum is going to continue. On that note, the next question I selected, this was also tied to active strategies, and I really like this one. So the question was, which investment style would you consider investing in actively managed ETFs? And I should note, people could select more than one answer here when you hear these results. But the runaway winner was U.S. small and mid caps. So 76% of respondents said they would consider active ETFs here. The second highest response was international equities with 58%. And then 50% said they would consider active in U.S. large caps and thematic equity strategies. And then finally, 39% said they would consider active in fixed income. What did you think about the small and mid cap standing out like that?
So again, I was encouraged by this. And let me just cite the latest SPIVA scorecard from S&P Dow Jones Indices. It showed that small and mid-cap, those are active mutual funds, but they did better versus their respective S&P benchmarks than the large-cap space over the last 3 years. It was in small caps, it was roughly half of the active small-cap mutual funds were performing in line or better than the benchmark. And so I like the fact that I also wrote about this piece. Thanks for highlighting content that I have on ETFtrends.com, looking at some of the active small cap funds, small cap equity ETFs that are available. And so I highlighted Dimensional Funds and Avantis that tilt towards quality and value in these broadly diversified ETFs and their respective small cap ETFs. AVSC is the Avantis one. DFAC is a Dimensional one. Both of those have outperformed in the past year. The iShares S&P 600 small cap index ETF That's encouraging that they are performing well. And then I also highlighted a few of the more concentrated products. So we've got some of the leaders in the space. Fidelity has a small cap ETF, FFSM. T. Rowe Price has a small mid cap ETF. The ticker is TMSL. And then Goldman Sachs has one that I highlighted. The ticker is GSC. So apologies for listing a bunch of products that are out there, but those are well-known asset managers that now have a small cap presence. And I'll just state the obvious. These are relatively small ETFs, which to me is a good thing because, as you know, as an advisor, many active small cap mutual funds that perform well close their door to new investors. That is down the road a risk for active small cap ETFs, but right now with $100 million or less, these funds can certainly stay open for the foreseeable future.
My quick color commentary here would just be that I can tell you in conversations I've had with investors and other advisors, small caps definitely seem to have some momentum behind them, with the thought being they've underperformed large cap, you know, fairly substantially over the last several years. And there's this feeling that maybe they could play catch up and show some outperformance here moving forward. The reason why that's important as it pertains specifically to actively managed ETFs, I think a lot of advisors and investors would tell you there's some concern about a lot of landmines in the small cap space. We've talked about zombie companies before, and you know, especially with interest rates where they're at, some of these over-leveraged companies not being able to really service their debt. And so maybe having an active manager at the wheel here can do a better job of sidestepping some of those landmines, and then obviously pursuing opportunities. So I did think that was interesting. By the way, were you surprised fixed income was so low? That's actually where I thought we would have seen more advisors say they're interested in active strategies. I think, especially given the rate environment and uncertainty around the Fed and inflation, did that surprise you at all?
It did. Now, I guess the caveat that this question was asked during an equity symposium,
fair.
So perhaps
yeah.
The advisors that are interested in active fixed income weren't, you know, this is a subset of the advisor community. And I certainly believe that they're there based on the flows, based on money continuing to go into active, both fixed income mutual funds and ETFs. And as you noted, at the top of the show, we have a fixed income symposium taking place coming up in a couple of weeks on April 18th with many of the active managers like Capital Group and PIMCO. So I know they're out there, advisors, but they just didn't respond as aggressively in this poll question.
Well, you have a good to-do for that fixed income symposium to bless us with some more excellent data like this from advisors. Just a few minutes left here, Todd. I want to touch on a couple more questions. And Vettify did have several polling questions around international stocks. And the one I want to ask you about in particular was, how much exposure do you have in emerging market equities in your average client portfolio? And I'll tell you, the results here didn't surprise me one bit. So 55% said only between 1 and 5% of their portfolio was in emerging market stocks. 28% said emerging market stocks represent between 6 and 10% of their client portfolios. 13% said zero, and then 4% said more than 10%. And again, this didn't surprise me at all, just given the returns we've seen over the past decade or so. I think, you know, I love giving this stat, and this is 100% cherry-picked, but if you look at the iShares Emerging Markets ETF, ticker EEM, that thing has returned exactly 13% since right before the global financial crisis in December 2007. That's total return over that time period. But in any event, any comments on the results of this question?
So again, I'm not surprised at all, although the people who have zero exposure to it, that's a bit surprising to me, in that is at some point emerging markets will do better. That's just, you know, the data will back that up, but also what type of emerging markets ETF. So as you've talked about on the show beforehand, the emerging markets ex-China ETFs have been popular. iShares has the largest of those products, EMXC, that's tied to the MSCI Emerging Markets Broader Index. It just strips out China from it. Columbia has one of these products also. The ticker is XC. CEM. That's been very popular as well. And I think we both know Perth Coal relatively well. Perth runs the index behind the Freedom 100 Emerging Markets ETF. The ticker is FRDM, which is Freedom weighted, which means China currently doesn't score very well and probably won't for my lifetime and yours. And that ETF, FRDM, is now $800 million in assets under management. So a sign that you can gather assets and you can actually perform well with certain emerging markets ETFs.
I'm glad you mentioned Perth Toll and the Freedom 100 Emerging Markets ETF, because perfect example of somebody who actually was able to push through the those gatekeepers we were talking about at the top of the show and with what Fidelity's doing. I love seeing the success of that ETF, as you said, around 800 million in assets. What an ETF success story. Todd, the last question I'm going to ask you is on thematic ETFs, which I think you know is a topic I always like discussing. And so the polling question you had was, how much does your average client portfolio have allocated to thematic ETFs? And just like with emerging market stocks, I would say this one didn't surprise me at all. So 38% said they only had between 1 and 5%. 27% said they had between 6 and 10% of their portfolio in thematic ETFs. 19% said zero. And then 17% said more than 10%, which I would say that seems a little high, but I guess that really depends on the type of strategy someone is running. But here's my question for you. Do you think there's too much focus from ETF issuers on the thematic ETF space? Because I think most people would agree thematic should only represent a smaller satellite position in a portfolio. And the results of your polling data would suggest that advisors agree with that as well, right? But I feel like we continue to see launch after launch after launch in the thematic ETF category. Is there too much product here? Like, shouldn't ETF issuers be paying more attention to data like yours instead of launching, the 12th cannabis ETF or whatever?
Well, so I think there's too many products overall in general, although as the head of research for TMX Vettify, I'm happy to continue to cover them. And I know you're happy to talk about the 3,000 plus ETFs week to week. But yes, there's too many thematic ETFs. There's too many, a range of different ETFs. I would argue there's too many Bitcoin ETFs. We now have 11, if I can slip in Bitcoin into the end of this segment. We've got 11 now, and Grayscale is going to offer a 12th one unless somebody beats them to it with their second product. So there's a lot of asset managers going after a small subset of the asset base that's available because they can't compete with the S&P 500 based products that are the core. But I couldn't help myself if we don't talk briefly about, it's important to look inside thematic ETFs. They're not all the same, unlike the Bitcoin ETFs, that the exposure is going to be the same. Let me just pick two products. Amplify has an online retail ETF. iBuy and ProShares has an online retail ETF, ONLN. iBuy has 70 holdings. The largest weighting is roughly 5%. ProShares has 19 holdings, and Amazon's weighting is a quarter of the portfolio. Those are very different ETFs. So if you have something different than what's out there, then it might make sense to appeal to an advisor, an investor base, even for their very small slice of the portfolio.
Yeah, and maybe to counter what I was saying, perhaps that's why we see ETF issuers launching a lot of category in the space, because they feel like they can differentiate, right? They feel like they can take a different tack towards a particular thematic ETF category and differentiate and hopefully be able to attract some investor interest. And I also don't want to contradict what I was saying at the beginning in terms of ETF innovation, because a lot of these smaller ETF issuers, for whatever reason, do seem to focus on the thematic category. And I think that gets back to what you were saying. They don't necessarily have to compete with the BlackRocks and Vanguards of the world in core portfolio exposure. So I like that we see innovation here. I would just suggest that if you're an ETF issuer listening to this podcast, maybe pay some attention to the Vettify advisor polling data. Would you agree with that?
Oh, I certainly would agree with that. And that's part of why we do this, is to hear from advisors, so that asset managers, so that we can do it ourselves to be able to talk and educate. You want to go where the investor interest is, and you want to use data to help be a true source for you, as opposed to what is your gut and do you think you can compete within that overall space. Data is definitely your friend.
The absolute perfect bookend to our conversation. Todd, great stuff as always. Again, I just love seeing how other advisors are thinking about portfolio construction. Always interesting. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks a lot for having me.
That was Todd Rosenbluth, head of research at VettaFi.
Growth and innovation, two words that best describe the ETF industry. However, rapid growth and innovation creates a critical need for financial advisors and industry practitioners' education. Enter the ETF Institute, the first and only independent organization providing industry professionals and financial advisors with certification, education, and training on ETFs. Learn more about the Certified ETF Advisor designation by visiting cetf.org.
My next guest is Felix Tabari, co-founder and CEO of Troop, who is making it much easier to build and apply custom proxy voting policies. Clearly an important topic, and Felix is now joining me from New York. Felix, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me.
All right, so look, I always like covering the basics. And so to begin here, if you'll indulge me, I want to start with some of those basics, and then we can certainly get into much more detail and obviously discuss some of these specific issues that Troop is seeking to solve. But first, I would just love to have you explain proxy voting at a high level. What is this?
Sure thing. So look, publicly traded companies, they report on their activities to shareholders through annual meetings. And typically, before those meetings, shareholders receive information on topics to be voted about at the meeting, share ownership, the structure of the board of directors, salary packages, and sometimes other proposals submitted by other shareholders. It's basically just the act of voting, saying yes, no, or abstain, or deciding who you want to nominate to the board. And you execute your vote once a year at the annual shareholder meeting.
And traditionally, how has this process gone? And perhaps we can break this into to two pieces. So you have individual investors who may directly own a stock. And then, of course, you have fund managers who are obviously owning stock on behalf of investors. Now, I'll tell you, my sense is a lot of individual investors, unfortunately, just throw their proxies in the trash. So I guess tell me if you agree with that. And then what about fund managers and their role around proxy voting?
Sure thing. So you're right that most retail shareholders, just by looking at the numbers, tend not to exercise their right to vote, which is, I suppose, understandable in the sense that they don't necessarily have a very strong incentive to do so. However, asset managers, money managers in general, typically do have a fiduciary obligation to vote the shares that they are managing. And so in that sense, it's quite different. They tend to take that rather seriously. There's an entire industry that's propped up basically supporting proxy voting, typically composed of proxy advisors, so two firms that exist in this space, ISS and Glass Lewis, and I suppose us now as well. And then there's one very large vote machine that basically has built out the infrastructure and the plumbing behind proxy voting, and that company is called Broadridge. And that's roughly the lay of the land for proxy voting.
All right, so perfect segue here. You mentioned those proxy advisory services. Explain for us what you're doing at Troop and some of the issues you're attempting to solve.
Sure thing. So if you think about what goes into a fund, typically it's a lot of different stocks, and it, you know, in theory, because you have the obligation to vote, you're supposed to be you're supposed to be showing up at every annual shareholder meeting. But as you can imagine, that's kind of difficult to do. It's also hard to make an informed voting decision on dozens and dozens and dozens, or sometimes hundreds, stocks that you have in your portfolio that, again, you're responsible to be voting for. And so proxy advisory essentially exists in order to help asset managers make quick and well-informed decisions on how to vote. And that's basically what we do. We help companies, funds, basically figure out how they feel about voting, what they think is important to focus on, what types of people they want on boards, what types of issues they care about, and then simply our technology enables them to, in simple conversational English, generate a proxy voting policy that they can then seamlessly apply to vote on their behalf at all annual shareholder meetings for all the stocks in their portfolio.
And to be clear, are you only working directly with fund managers, or do you have tools that individual investors could use as well?
So this is really just for fund managers. We used to have an interface for retail shareholders. We no longer do, but I'm happy to get into that when we talk a little bit about the origin story of Troop.
Well, one of the reasons I ask, and hopefully this makes sense, is that, you know, over the past, I would say, year or two, we've seen these initiatives from firms like Vanguard and Schwab and State Street, I believe BlackRock as well, where essentially end investors can provide at least some input into how their proxies are voted. I guess I'd be curious, how an initiative like that compares or contrasts with what you're doing, and then just what you think of that initiative or those initiatives overall.
Yeah. So, look, I think it's good signal. Whatever their intentions and motivations might be, as far as we're concerned at Troop, I think it's a good thing that the world's largest asset managers are looking to try and return some voting decision and some participation decision over to ultimately their clients, who are all for the most part retail shareholders in these funds. The way that a few of the larger names are doing it is that they are letting you choose from a drop-down list of kind of prefabricated voting policies that most likely represent the different sets of values and policy preferences that most people have. And in our view, I think that's a good step in the right direction. I think it's a lot to ask people to show up and vote every single ballot item on every single stock that they have in their portfolio. And so this makes it a little bit easier for them. To be honest, BlackRock is setting it up this year in their iShares ETF, one of their biggest ones, and we'll see. We'll see towards the end of this annual shareholder meeting season, which takes place between now and the end of June, essentially what people selected, what their participation rate was, did that influence or change any of the votes. It's going to be pretty exciting.
Yeah, you mentioned what the intentions and motivations of some of these firms may be. I'll tell you, I think one of the reasons why a company like, say, Vanguard or BlackRock is doing this is because there has been some pushback or concern that these firms own too much of individual companies. And you might recall, I'm sure you do, that Vanguard founder Jack Bogle, in his last op-ed in the Wall Street Journal before he passed away, he talked about this concern of Vanguard wielding too much power in corporate boardrooms. I'm curious if you agree that's something that larger fund companies will continue to need to address. And I'll color that by also saying I was just reading yesterday in the Wall Street Journal where they were talking about this proxy battle at Disney, right, where you have Nelson Peltz and Trian Partners, who's a hedge fund. They're making this activist push to get some board seats. But then BlackRock they came out and said they're going to support Disney in pushing back, just as an example of maybe a larger fund company wielding that power. What do you think about all that?
Yeah, I think it's honestly fascinating. And speaking of which, the Disney AGM is actually going to take place tomorrow. So we'll probably find out relatively soon after the AGM, who ends up winning those board seats. But it's quite fascinating. I think that you know, as you mentioned, Mr. Vogel did indeed, send a small word of warning about what happens when there's a little bit too much consolidated power. I think ultimately what he's hinting at is the early concepts of anti-competition, and it can become a little bit difficult. You know, it's probably not a good thing for over 50% of the industry to be bundled up into funds that ultimately run up to, you know, two or three large holders. There's just a lot of concentration of power and influence. In any particular direction, I think it's probably not great. You know, concentration of power is something that you want to try and avoid a little bit. That being said, I mean, you know, last year when a few of these large asset managers experimented with kicking back voting rights to their institutional investor clients, those very same clients kicked back the voting decision to BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard, basically saying, you know, well, guys, what are we paying you for, right? It's part of the responsibility for the large asset manager to do that. And so I think what that opened up is a whole conversation about the value that you're getting from this voting technology and the voting interface and the proxy advisory. And that's the conversation that we're really excited to get into.
I think sort of on that topic, I'd be curious if you have any specific views on ESG, where, you know, there's been some concern that companies should be focused on maximizing shareholder value and not on some of the social agenda type stuff, those sorts of things. And obviously, those aren't mutually exclusive, right? I'm not getting into that debate today, but you may have heard of an ETF issuer called Strive, where their entire thrust is that they're going to push companies to maximize shareholder value. But then on the other hand, there's an ETF issuer like Engine Number One, who they successfully filled some board seats at Exxon with directors who are more climate conscious. I'm just curious if you have any thoughts around sort of that whole ESG debate.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's an interesting one. I have two views on ESG. The first is, I mean, above all else, it was initiated as a sort of accounting system to try and measure to a certain extent companies' environmental and or societal and or governance practices. I think what's confusing is mixing environmental and societal concepts along with just basic governance concepts. I think that the G in ESG should probably be separated entirely. But, you know, at the end of the day, especially, for example, if you're a thematic fund that has a specific mission either to, I don't know, deploy capital and support, eco-friendly or green initiatives, or on the other hand, you're a thematic fund focused on supporting the oil and gas industry, whatever it may be. Ultimately, what you would want is your proxy voting choices to reflect, the theme of your fund. And I think one of the issues is typically we're not seeing a lot of variance in voting outcomes, and that's also because in addition to the concentration of power, you know, within BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard, you also have a lot of concentration in market ownership in the two main proxy advisory firms, in particular one that tends to dominate the market. And so as a result, if you have a lot of people consuming the same research, you will end up with voting outcomes that are roughly the same, which in our view is a little bit of a shame because it's our view that each of these funds who spend a lot of time building out strategy and identity, et cetera, aren't really able to have a voting policy that reflects that. So whether it's ESG or not, I mean, in our view, it actually should be more complex than that. There's a ton of data out there to make really, really customized and very specific voting decisions based on your fund, and that's really what we're pushing people to consider.
Felix, just a couple of minutes left. If we come full circle here, why did you start Troop? Like where did the passion around this initially come from for you?
Yeah, so you actually mentioned Engine Number One. I think that was a really fascinating example. It happened in 2021, and that was a form of, you know, shareholder activism, but in particular hedge fund activism. So at the time, Engine Number One was a hedge fund before they spun up their ETF. At roughly around the same time, a story that is on a totally different side of the spectrum on retail shareholder investing, GameStop happened, where a whole bunch of retail shareholders, you know, loaded up on GameStop shares. But the most interesting thing to me in that story is that, you know, like nearly 90% of the retail shareholders in GameStop showed up at the AGM and vote at the annual shareholder meeting and exercised their right to vote their shares. And, you know, looking at those two headlines side by side, there was a bit of an aha moment. Like, there's something here. That it might be the right time and the right place. Let's take a look at the market for governance and kind of figure out, like, are there ways to get people to exercise more shareholder voting responsibilities? Are there ways to get asset managers to think about it more creatively? And, you know, two and a half, three years of kind of obsessive pursuit of that thought has landed us where we're at today.
Well, Felix, I'll tell you, I just find this whole topic to be fascinating. I know proxy voting puts some people to sleep, not me. I think there's so much here. Clearly, it doesn't put you to sleep as well. But look, best of luck to you moving forward. Hopefully, we can connect again down the road. And thank you for joining me.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
That was Felix Tabari, co-founder and CEO of Troop. I am now joined by Jess Bost, Vice President of Strategic Partnerships at Alpha Architect, who currently offers 10 ETFs, nearly $4 billion in assets, which I've got to say, that's more than doubled in the past year or so. But Jess has an interesting role here. So she works directly with registered investment advisors to help them with investment management and portfolio construction, and really just educating them on everything from ETFs to running their practice. And she's now on the line with me from Augusta, Georgia. Jess, so great to finally have you on the podcast. Thank you for joining me.
All right. Yeah, absolutely. It's so great to be here. Appreciate the invite. Yeah, let's get rolling.
All right. So did I describe your role with Alpha Architect correctly? Perhaps you can expand on that a little bit.
Sure. Yeah, no, you did a great job. A lot of people do ask what that role actually entitles and what I do and what it means. Essentially, when I came into the role at Alpha Architect, I came in with a big understanding of people and a very little understanding of investing. So I've spent a lot of the last couple of years learning from the team on how to invest the best way, on how to analyze investments and how to use ETFs inside a portfolio. And what I try to do is just translate that to the everyday advisor that I'm most familiar with, the role that I understand pretty well in this industry and maybe best in this industry is that advisor role. And I'm just trying to take what we know, what the quants know at Alpha Architect, and help communicate that well and create that bridge between really what we do and what they do and try to help the client further.
You mentioned coming in knowing a lot about people, but maybe not quite as much about investing. I would love to hear more about your background. And, you know, you and I have been connected on Twitter or X for quite a while now. So I do feel like I'm fairly familiar with your backstory. But for people unfamiliar with you, just take us through your career path and how you ultimately ended up with Alpha Architect.
Sure. So I started, my major in college was actually psychology. And it wasn't that I couldn't do math. I just didn't like it so much. And I took a psychology class and really just fell in love with the idea that I could understand people better and help them along their paths and lives. And so that kind of translated into several roles in different places until I ended up in a CrossFit gym and found out there that people were coming to a gym, people were coming to fitness with this idea of, I need help getting from where I am to where I want to be. So I have these goals out in front of me and I want to accomplish them. I just don't know how to get there. And so that's where that original passion for starting with someone where they are, helping them get to where they want to be, that's where that started to cultivate and develop, was inside CrossFit and as a personal trainer and coach there. And then that I had a client who's a financial advisor, actually, and that was my transition point over to financial services, was realizing after I went to work for him in the front office and started answering phones, realized, hey, I'm encountering the same kind of human problems here. People are stuck. They want to get somewhere with their finances. They have these goals in front of them of retiring or going on big trips or buying a house, and they can't do that, and they're inviting someone and asking for someone to come help them figure that out.
You mentioned the CrossFit. I have to ask you about the deadlifting and the burpees and everything else I see you post out on Twitter. Has the personal fitness and training, has that always been a passion for you?
It has. I played sports in high school, didn't in college, mostly because I didn't want to make it my whole life. And I was probably on the fringe of actually being a super competitive college athlete. It wasn't something I would have had to have dedicated my entire life and worked really hard for it. But I've always enjoyed sports. When I found CrossFit, it was really the first time, though, that as a woman, somebody had put a barbell in my hands and said, this is yours. You can really own this. And so I fell in love with the barbell, the way that I felt like I could be strong. And that was a way to build fitness and a way to build health. And that was a new concept to me. And also has also translated into just this passion for people who may feel like they don't understand a lot about investing, helping them kind of onboard through things that excite them, things that may not have been exposed to before. It all builds into my passion and my conviction about really that building wealth is for anyone, and not for everyone, because you do have to be willing to put the work in and figure some things out for yourself, but anyone can do that. And so that's a lot about my investing and finance philosophy that comes is borrowed from the fitness world.
All right, so you are giving me the absolute perfect segue here, because we're going to talk ETFs and model portfolios and really discuss how advisors can use ETFs to simplify and optimize model portfolio construction. So you have an overall framework here that you like to use. As I understand, that actually incorporates your personal fitness background as well, which I just love. So, Jess, I'm just going to open this up to you. Take us through your model portfolio framework.
Sure. So I look at this, like I said, coming into this with the concept and mindset that maybe not everybody understands finance, but most people understand fitness. They can kind of use that analogy of fitness to translate over and feel a little more comfortable in a space that otherwise they may not be willing to step into. So this model development approach really starts with the framework and the concepts from fitness, and then I use those to translate over to finance, just to, again, help advisors understand how to really approach this topic that can feel a little intangible. So the first piece of that that I'll start with is, you know, maybe sitting down, one of the first things that you need to look at when you're developing models for your clients or for your practice is, what kind of accounts do I need? And so we're looking at maybe a taxable account versus a tax-deferred account versus a tax-free account. Like, those are the big three accounts that maybe we need to set out to build with our clients. And to me, that looks a little bit and kind of feels a lot like deciding, where are you going to work out? Are you going to work out at home? Are you going to use a public gym? Are you going to be outside because you're a runner? Do you need to have days where you can train inside if you are running? And what are the options that you need there? So just really from a macro standpoint, figuring out where are these assets going to go is a big piece of just getting oriented with your clients and with your portfolios.
Okay, and so once you have the where, what about the what in terms of what you're going to allocate to?
Yeah, I mean, you need to know, one, for account minimums, investment minimums. Maybe if you have managed accounts and brokerage accounts, if you are up under a broker-dealer, you need to have an idea of how much do I need to build up in this account before I have access to a managed account. And I look at that similar to, like, how much time do I have to work out each day or each week? So you're kind of looking at this idea of constraints and how can I fill up these buckets, and how does that translate over to what I need to do in order to reach my goals? Because if I have 30 minutes a day and I'm training for a marathon, I'm going to break that up differently versus if I have 2 hours a day. Or maybe that does create some exclusions for me. Maybe I don't have access to a marathon if I only have 30 minutes a day. So you're kind of breaking this up based on, the account minimums, investment minimums. You really need to take a look at what the constraints are with your brokerage or your platform, your custodian that you're working with.
And again, what about specifically just on asset class determination?
Yeah. So, like, you know, when you're talking about U.S., ex-U.S., core, satellite, if you want emerging markets exposure, the analogy for me is, what kind of workouts do I enjoy doing? What do I want to do? What do I need to do in order to hit those goals? And so a lot of people, when they're thinking about these allocation, it feels very, again, intangible is a word that I come back to a lot. Like, I don't know how much to put in U.S. versus ex-U.S. And then we hear some questions like that a lot. And really it comes back to some tolerance. Like, what do you talk about? What do you think your clients are liking? What do you think they want to do? What do they need to do? And there's some good guidelines out there. There's maybe not a perfect equation for some of these questions, but it does really, especially if you're looking at incorporating real estate or gold for clients, it does come down a lot of times to matching your offering with their preferences or setting the expectation out on the front end of the conversation of, these are some of the things that you can expect to have in the portfolio, and then backfilling from there. But really, it is a little bit preferential at that point, and that's okay. When we go into the gym, we're going to want to orient our workouts long-term around the things that we like doing. Otherwise, if at some point in time, we're going to hit a wall where we really don't want to be there, really don't want to be doing the things that we're doing, and it doesn't align with our values and our long-term willingness to stay in it. And of course, we know with investing, a big part of that long-term strategy is just being willing to stay in whatever you're invested in.
I want to ask you specifically about ETF selection, but before we do that, anything else you would highlight in terms of just this overall model portfolio framework?
We get a lot of questions about, how much should we pay for certain investments, especially when we get to the ETF level, because you're talking about expense ratios built into some of these products. And really that you have to be able to look at it from the perspective of, how much should this cost me? If we're looking at fitness routines, some are expensive, some are cheap, and they should align. You shouldn't be paying $175 a month for somebody to give you a 5K workout program, a couch to 5K workout program, when you can get that for free. So figuring out, inside the market, how much something should cost really is just about doing a little bit of research to see, how does it align with its peers? And then that risk profile and risk exposure, you really want to look at offering different levels of risk, especially when you're looking at building a portfolio for your clients. You're looking at something similar to teaching a fitness class as opposed to personal training in a lot of senses, especially if you're building one big portfolio for your overall firm. And so you want to be able to offer different levels of risk exposure to those clients within that model that you've constructed.
You mentioned expense ratios. Obviously, that gets us down the path towards the ETF selection process. And so once an advisor has defined this broader framework that you've walked through, obviously, now comes a part where they have to filter through the 3,400 plus ETFs out there and find the ones that make the most sense. How do you think about that process?
Yeah, so the idea of selecting ETFs really is about trying to approximate an SMA strategy. So instead of selecting 50 stocks, 50 individual stocks for your portfolio, you're going to look for an ETF that could capture the essence of those 50 stocks, and to put that one ETF in your portfolio instead. And so what you're essentially doing with that is, you are pulling this lever of time and ease and access, and maybe the switch there for the advisor is to be able to access a product, an ETF, if you will, inside their portfolio in a way that eases some of the due diligence that they might have to do individually on those stocks. So the one way to think about that is, instead of constructing a deadlift program for yourself where you're going out and looking at all the different ways that you could improve your deadlift. You are finding someone who has created a deadlift program, and you choose to purchase their deadlift program and follow that program for a given time period, maybe 6 weeks, maybe 12 weeks, maybe 6 months. And then at the end of that time period, when you have an idea of expected gains, you're going to evaluate, did I gain enough? Did I do enough during this time to justify the cost of hiring that person or buying that program? If I did, then maybe I'm going to continue with their next phase of that or continue to use that same program, reset my maxes, and go back through it again. And so that, to me, the idea of an ETF really is just accessing a broad maybe concept or strategy for performance inside your portfolio that you could do individually. It's just going to take a lot more time and effort and research and intention to continue to construct that individually for yourself versus leaning on the expert and the advice and the construction of someone else's program.
You have my mind running with all of these personal fitness analogies. So I have to ask you, spot Bitcoin ETFs. Do you have a good analogy for those on the personal fitness side?
Well, I mean, so spot Bitcoin ETFs are a new product, right? And it's so funny. I knew we were going to go here. of course we're going to go here, Nate. For me, it's like maybe even if you want to step back a few years, the birth of CrossFit. So CrossFit came onto the scene maybe somewhere around 2000, depending on how attuned you were, maybe 2007, 2008, anywhere between that and 2012 before it really hit mainstream. And during that time, people were super skeptical of this program that was emerging as a kind of a one-stop shop for fitness and strength building. And so similar to the kind of the Bitcoin emergence, people are skeptical about whether or not that could be something that could be additive to their portfolio, whether or not that's something that they want to consider as an investment. And, you know, the thing that I think is makes it a little easier to understand is, one, if you do not feel like you are on the edge of your fitness, if you're on the edge of your portfolio looking for that next right thing for your portfolio, then maybe Bitcoin is something to sit back and these Bitcoin ETFs are something to sit back and watch a little bit for. There's nothing wrong with that if you aren't ready for the next thing. But if you are on the edge of your portfolio, you are looking for that next right thing, then maybe Bitcoin is something for you to put your toes in the water and experience and figure out. The Bitcoin ETF makes that super accessible because, again, you are relying on someone who has constructed a product for you to fit into the portfolio that could work for you. And you're just going to step in. So it's like adding like maybe one CrossFit class a week instead of changing your entire running program over to a CrossFit program. Maybe you're just going to add one day a week. See how that feels. See how that works for you. If you like it, if you're getting some results, if it's pulling you in, you want to do a little more, add 2 days a week. So there are ways to approach these new ideas if they fit within your framework of something that you might want to experience. There's ways to add those in that are cost beneficial, right? That do not introduce too many risks and still allow you to experience it. And that's one of my favorite things about the Bitcoin ETF is for folks who really weren't sure, they couldn't pull that lever of ease of adding assets or investing in Bitcoin through some of the other institutions and the other products that have been put forth into the market. This ETF, especially if they're already familiar with ETFs, if you're already going to group classes at a Globo gym and now there's a CrossFit class that's being offered, like, you're just going to put your toes in the water there. You're just going to try it out. As long as it fits with, if you're not somebody who's trying to build strength, maybe CrossFit isn't for you. If you're not trying to someone that's trying to have exposure to some of these fringe asset classes, which is what I would put Bitcoin in at the moment. I think we are adopting as a lot more mainstream, but it's still moving in that direction from the fringes. Then maybe it's maybe it's not right for you if you're not looking for those kinds of additional pieces to your portfolio. And again, as if you're an advisor and you are considering that for your clients, ETFs, one, are a lot easier to add to the portfolio offerings, and they're also something that it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to have it in there since it's an ETF. If it's not something that your clients are looking for, doesn't fit the framework, doesn't fit the ideology of what you've been explaining to your clients all along that you are doing, it's okay not to do it if what you're doing is already working for your clients' goals and for the outcomes that you're looking for.
Jess, we only have about 2 minutes left here. Before I let you go, in your experience working with advisors on model portfolio construction, I'm curious, where do you typically see the biggest mistakes made? And obviously, there's no perfect solution out there. I think we all know that. But from your perspective, what's maybe the biggest issue or the biggest two issues you come across? And this can be on either the broader portfolio framework or the ETF selection process itself. You know, what's sort of like the poor form when you're deadlifting or, I don't know, not running heel to toe mistakes that you see out there?
Yeah, I would say two main ones. One is going to be the due diligence time that you're investing in your portfolio. I think a lot of people will skip some of the homework that really does need to be done if they are building a stock strategy and go straight to maybe some of the shortcuts, expense ratios, price earnings ratios, valuation techniques, some of these things that really do require a significant amount of time. They'll shortcut them in order to put a new hot idea into their portfolio and really disalign with their idea of a long-term investment strategy. That's one big one. And again, I think ETFs are a good solution for that because you can evaluate the ETF company or, you know, the ETF provider as opposed to, or the ETF concept as opposed to analyzing individual stocks. And so that can create some shortcut for you there in a meaningful way, in a way that could be additive to your portfolio. And then the other thing that I see is what we talk about a lot of times is closet indexing. So people that are maybe including a strategy that they think is doing something other than just the basic S&P 500 index ETF, and they think that it's maybe an active strategy that's adding something extra, but when you look underneath the hood, you realize really it's just mimicking or it's highly correlated with the S&P 500. And to me, you know, that's like going to paying $150, $200, like I said, for a month for this Couch to 5K program that you could just go online and get for free. And it's probably, without some additional coaching, it's probably not going to be meaningfully any different. I do see a lot of advisors that are trying, and they're doing it in good faith. They're trying to incorporate these new ideas, but really they're just not extending the breadth of the portfolio through the cost that they're passing along ultimately to their clients.
Well, Jess, we're going to have to leave it there. This was fun. I like the unique viewpoint and working in the personal fitness side. Again, very interesting. And by the way, I love seeing all of the success that you and the Alpha Architect team are having. Just love seeing that. So keep up the good work. And thank you for joining me this week.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Nate.
That was Jess Bost, Vice President of Strategic Partnerships at Alpha Architect. That'll do it for this week's ETF Prime. I want to thank one of our sponsors, Kalamos Investments. If you would like to learn more about Kalamos ETFs, you can visit kalamos.com/ETFs. Next week, I will be joined by Chris Davis, Chairman of Davis Advisors. We are going to discuss the current markets and valuations and also take a look at several of their actively managed ETFs. Until then, have a great week, everyone.